Have you ever wondered why scientific issues that should be settled, like climate change, smoking's health effects, or acid rain, remain controversial in public discourse? Picture this: a small group of influential scientists, veterans of the Cold War, deliberately creating confusion about scientific evidence to prevent regulation of industries they ideologically supported. This isn't conspiracy theory, it's documented history. Naomi Oreskes in Eric Conway's Merchants of Doubt meticulously traces how these scientists used their prestigious credentials to manufacture uncertainty about well-established scientific findings. The book has become required reading in many science policy courses, with Al Gore citing Oreskes' research in An Inconvenient Truth. Its cultural impact extends beyond academia. Leonardo DiCaprio referenced its findings in his climate documentary Before the Flood, and a 2014 documentary film adaptation brought these revelations to wider audiences. What makes this investigation particularly compelling is its documentation of how the same tactics, and often the same individuals, move from issue to issue, from tobacco to acid rain to climate change, using identical playbooks to delay regulation through manufactured doubt. In 1969, a tobacco executive penned a revealing memo that would become the blueprint for decades of science denial. Doubt is our product, since it is the best means of competing with the body of fact that exists in the minds of the general public. This insight, that normal scientific uncertainty could be weaponized to undermine established knowledge, became the foundation for nearly every campaign against inconvenient scientific findings in the last half century. The tobacco industry pioneered this approach when confronted with evidence linking smoking to cancer. Rather than directly challenging the science, they created an alternative narrative emphasizing uncertainty. More research is needed, became their mantra, while they funded studies designed to find alternative explanations for lung cancer. They understood that if people believed the science was unsettled, they would continue their habits without demanding regulation. What's remarkable is how successfully this strategy transferred to other issues. The same scientists who defended tobacco, particularly physicists Frederick Seitz and S. Fred Singer, later applied identical tactics to acid rain, the ozone hole, and climate change. These weren't random connections. Documents revealed deliberate recruitment of scientists with established credentials who could lend authority to industry positions. The genius of the doubt strategy is its asymmetry. Scientists must prove their case beyond reasonable doubt, while denial requires only raising questions. As one tobacco memo noted, doubt is also the limit of our product. We cannot take a position directly opposing the anti-cigarette forces and say that cigarettes are a contributor to good health. No information that we have supports such a claim. This approach exploits a fundamental aspect of science itself, its inherent caution and acknowledgement of uncertainty. Scientists qualify their statements, acknowledge limitations, and specify confidence levels. These necessary scientific practices became weapons in the hands of those seeking to prevent regulation, who could point to any expression of uncertainty as evidence that the science isn't settled. Who were these merchants of doubt? Primarily, they were physicists whose careers had flourished during the Cold War through weapons development and defense research. Frederick Seitz had worked on the atomic bomb and later became president of the National Academy of Sciences. S. Fred Singer directed the National Weather Satellite Service. William Nirenberg directed the Scripps Institution of Oceanography while working on defense projects. Robert Jastrow founded NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. These men shared not just scientific backgrounds, but hawkish Cold War politics. They opposed detente and arms control, believing the Soviet threat required an aggressive military posture. This worldview led them to support Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI, or Star Wars, despite scientific criticism of its feasibility. When Carl Sagan and other scientists warned that nuclear war might trigger a catastrophic nuclear winter, these Cold Warriors saw it as a threat to their defense priorities. In response, they created the George C. Marshall Institute in 1984, initially to defend SDI from scientific criticism. The Institute's founding chairman was Frederick Seitz, with Jastrow and Nirenberg as directors. The Marshall Institute's approach foreshadowed their later environmental skepticism. They attacked both the science of nuclear winter and the scientists themselves, particularly Sagan, whom they portrayed as politically motivated. When Sagan published in Parade magazine before peer review, they seized on this procedural irregularity to question the entire concept, despite subsequent peer-reviewed studies confirming the basic phenomenon, though with less severe effects than initially predicted. As the Cold War ended, these scientists found a new enemy in environmentalism, which they viewed as a stalking horse for government regulation and ultimately socialism. Their defense of free markets became an ideological crusade against any science suggesting capitalism produced harmful side effects requiring regulation. The acid rain controversy of the 1980s served as a dress rehearsal for later climate denial tactics. By the late 1970s, scientific evidence had firmly established that sulfur dioxide emissions from coal-burning power plants were causing acidification of lakes and forests across the northeastern United States and Canada. The science was clear. Acid rain was real, human-caused, and damaging. When Ronald Reagan took office in 1981 on a deregulatory platform, his administration needed scientific cover to avoid addressing the problem. They turned to William Nirenberg to chair a review panel on acid rain, despite his lack of expertise in the field. Though most panel members affirm the scientific consensus, the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy inserted Fred Singer into the panel, where he consistently emphasized uncertainties and costs of regulation. When the panel's report was finalized, Nirenberg allowed the White House to rearrange its conclusions, emphasizing uncertainties while downplaying the clear evidence of damage. When panel members like Gene Likens protested these unauthorized changes, Nirenberg claimed confusion about the process, though documents later revealed he had a telecopied note reading, "Changes wanted by Keyworth, Reagan's science advisor." The media increasingly covered acid rain as an unsettled question, with business publications like Fortune and Business Week questioning the scientific consensus. When soil scientist Edward Krug argued that soil acidification might be natural, a perspective already rejected by mainstream scientists, right-wing publications eagerly promoted his views, creating lasting public confusion. It took 6 years and a new administration to finally pass legislation controlling acidic emissions. The 1990 Clean Air Act amendments established a cap-and-trade system that reduced sulfur dioxide by 54% between 1990 and 2007, while electricity prices actually decreased. The EPA later estimated that the benefits, $101 to $119 billion, exceeded costs, $8 to $9 billion, by more than 10 times, proving Singer's claim of a billion-dollar solution to a million-dollar problem completely wrong. The battle over ozone depletion represents one of the most significant environmental controversies of the 20th century, further refining industry's doubt strategy. When F. Sherwood Rowland and Mario Molina made their groundbreaking discovery in 1974 that chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, could destroy stratospheric ozone, they faced immediate and aggressive pushback. The chemical industry, led by manufacturers like DuPont, launched a multi-pronged attack challenging every aspect of their theory. They argued that CFCs, being heavy molecules, couldn't possibly reach the stratosphere, wouldn't break down if they did reach such heights, and that natural sources like volcanic chlorine were the real culprit in any observed ozone depletion. The scientific community responded with systematic research that methodically disproved each objection. Through a series of sophisticated atmospheric measurements and laboratory experiments, scientists demonstrated conclusively that CFCs did indeed reach the stratosphere, traveling upward through complex atmospheric mixing processes. They showed that these compounds broke down precisely at the predicted altitudes when exposed to high-energy ultraviolet radiation. The definitive evidence came when James Anderson's team detected significant levels of chlorine monoxide in the stratosphere, a chemical fingerprint that could only be explained by CFC breakdown, effectively proving that these compounds were actively participating in ozone destruction. The discovery of the Antarctic ozone hole in 1985 by British Antarctic Survey scientists Joe Farman, Brian Gardner, and Jonathan Shanklin marked a turning point in public awareness. This massive seasonal depletion of ozone over Antarctica became front-page news worldwide. NASA and NOAA responded by launching major research expeditions that revealed the complex chemistry at work. The extreme cold of Antarctic winters produced polar stratospheric clouds, whose ice crystals served as catalysts, dramatically accelerating chlorine-releasing reactions. Meanwhile, the polar vortex, a circular pattern of winds, trapped this cold air, creating a perfect environment for ozone destruction at rates far exceeding any previous model predictions. The 1987 Montreal Protocol emerged as a groundbreaking international response, establishing the first adaptive regulatory framework for addressing a global environmental threat. The protocol required periodic scientific reassessment and allowed for adjustments based on new evidence. This flexibility proved crucial as mounting evidence revealed ozone depletion extending beyond Antarctica into northern mid-latitudes, where the majority of Earth's population resided. This expanding threat eventually convinced even DuPont, the world's largest CFC manufacturer, to announce a phase-out of CFC production. Despite this scientific consensus and industrial acquiescence, prominent contrarian S. Fred Singer maintained his opposition through a sophisticated counter-narrative campaign. He repeatedly circulated the false claim that Gordon Dobson had discovered the ozone hole in 1956, suggesting it was a natural phenomenon. Singer also continued to assert that stratospheric chlorine came mostly from natural sources, despite clear evidence to the contrary. When Roland, Molina, and Paul Crutzen were awarded the 1995 Nobel Prize in Chemistry for their work on stratospheric ozone chemistry, Singer attacked the Nobel Committee, claiming they had made a political statement rather than recognizing genuine scientific achievement. By the mid-1980s, nearly everyone knew smoking caused cancer. Yet tobacco industry executives sustained doubt with help from scientists providing expert testimony in court cases. In 1986, a new Surgeon General's report concluding that secondhand smoke could cause cancer in non-smokers created industry panic as it shifted smoking from a personal choice to an action that harmed innocent bystanders. The industry responded with creative disinformation campaigns, paying celebrities to use tobacco products in films, creating special projects to develop countervailing evidence, and recruiting scientists through Project White Coat to maintain controversy. Their top objective, with a $16 million budget, was to maintain the controversy about tobacco smoke in public and scientific forums. When the EPA released its 1992 report classifying environmental tobacco smoke as a Class A carcinogen responsible for 3,000 lung cancer deaths annually, Seitz and Singer led the counterattack. Singer collaborated with Philip Morris's PR firm to write articles claiming the EPA used junk science and rigged the numbers by accepting a 90% confidence level rather than the standard 95%. The EPA defended its approach by explaining that their linear dose response model followed both scientific practice and Occam's razor, used the simplest theory without unnecessary complications. When evidence shows something is harmful, common sense suggests more exposure means more risk. Singer's recycling of arguments from debates about nuclear power and pesticides revealed this wasn't really about secondhand smoke science. For Philip Morris, which reported record profits in 1995, the goal was protecting their bottom line. But for scientists like Singer and Seitz, the motivation was ideological. An implacable hostility to regulation as the road to socialism, and a commitment to free market fundamentalism. Many Americans believe global warming is a relatively recent scientific concern, yet scientific research on carbon dioxide and climate dates back 150 years, beginning with John Tyndall's establishment of CO2 as a greenhouse gas, followed by Svante Arrhenius's realization that fossil fuel burning could alter climate. By 1979, the scientific understanding was already robust. The JASENS, an elite scientific committee, found that doubling atmospheric CO2 would increase average surface temperatures by 2.4°C, with polar regions warming 10-12°C. A National Academy of Sciences panel under Jules Charny concluded that doubling CO2 would likely cause about 3°C warming, a finding remarkably consistent with today's estimates 4 decades later. When NASA scientist James Hansen testified to Congress in 1988 that global warming had begun and would accelerate without emissions reductions, the Marshall Institute found a new mission, challenging climate science. Their 1989 white paper, authored by Jastrow, Seitz, and Nirenberg, claimed warming didn't track CO2 increases because most warming occurred before 1940, followed by cooling through 1975. They argued this pattern matched solar activity cycles rather than carbon dioxide emissions. However, they had cherry-picked data, showing only one diagram from Hansen's research while omitting others that demonstrated the combined effects of CO2, volcanoes, and solar activity. The IPCC's first assessment in 1990 explicitly rejected this solar argument, explaining that even maximum solar variability would be swamped by the enhanced greenhouse effect. Singer launched a different attack by attempting to co-opt Roger Revelle's reputation. Revelle, Al Gore's former Harvard mentor and a pioneer of climate science, became Singer's unwitting tool when Singer approached the 81-year-old scientist about collaborating on an article shortly before Revelle suffered a massive heart attack. While Revelle was hospitalized and later recuperating, Singer sent him multiple drafts, eventually publishing a paper with Revelle as second author that contained the phrase, "The scientific base for a greenhouse warming is too uncertain to justify drastic action," words Singer had used in his own earlier publications, not Revelle's. After Revelle's death in July 1991, the paper was weaponized during the 1992 election campaign. Journalist Greg Easterbrook cited it to attack Al Gore, misleadingly attributing Singer's skeptical conclusions to Revelle himself. The Revelle family and his Scripps colleagues were infuriated by this misrepresentation, but their attempts to correct the record reached only scientific audiences while the misrepresentation circulated widely. The pattern of doubt merchandising extended to a particularly aggressive posthumous attack on Rachel Carson, whose landmark 1962 book Silent Spring had meticulously documented the ecological dangers of DDT and other synthetic pesticides. By the early 2000s, free market think tanks and industry-backed organizations were portraying Carson as worse than Hitler, claiming she was responsible for millions of malaria deaths in developing nations through her supposed role in DDT's worldwide banning. This campaign, orchestrated through various media outlets and policy papers, represented a calculated attempt to discredit one of environmentalism's founding figures. This revisionist narrative contained several significant falsehoods that distorted both Carson's actual positions and historical facts. First, Carson never called for an outright ban on DDT. Instead, she advocated for more careful, targeted use and warned against broadcast spraying that allowed the chemical to enter the entire food chain. Second, the EPA's 1972 ban applied only to agricultural uses within the United States, explicitly exempting public health applications, including malaria control programs worldwide. Third, DDT had already lost much of its effectiveness against malaria-carrying mosquitoes due to resistance development in many regions before any regulatory restrictions were implemented. In fact, this resistance problem had been documented in scientific literature as early as the 1950s. Recent medical research has powerfully validated Carson's original concerns about DDT's health impacts. Dr. Barbara Cohn's groundbreaking epidemiological work identified women from a 1960s Kaiser Permanente medical study who had been exposed to DDT during its peak usage period. Preserved blood samples from that era were reanalyzed using modern techniques and compared with breast cancer rates over the following decades. The results were striking. Women with high serum DDT levels showed a 5-fold increase in breast cancer risk. Additional studies have linked DDT exposure to other health problems, including reproductive disorders, developmental delays in children, and various cancers. The construction of this revisionist DDT history reveals the true agenda behind the attacks, defending extreme free market ideology by attempting to deny not just scientific facts, but historical ones as well. The coordinated assault on Carson's legacy serves a broader purpose: to discredit the environmental movement's successful push toward legal regulation of dangerous chemicals. If Carson could be painted as fundamentally wrong about DDT, then government intervention in markets through environmental protection could be portrayed as unnecessary and harmful. This campaign demonstrates how historical revisionism becomes a tool for contemporary political battles over regulation and corporate accountability. The controversy also highlights how Carson's actual message, advocating for careful study of environmental impacts and judicious use of chemical controls, was deliberately misrepresented to serve ideological ends. Her nuanced position, calling for balanced approaches, has been vindicated by modern research, while the simplistic DDT is harmless narrative, promoted by her critics, has been thoroughly debunked by scientific evidence. The Merchants of Doubt created a scientific Potemkin village, an elaborate facade of institutes, conferences, and publications that mimicked legitimate science without adhering to its rigorous standards. The tobacco industry pioneered this approach, establishing sophisticated-sounding organizations like the Tobacco Institute and Center for Indoor Air Research. These entities sponsored lavish conferences, funded selective research projects, and even created pseudo-scientific journals complete with superficial peer review processes. The Council for Tobacco Research, for instance, distributed millions in research grants while carefully avoiding studies that might implicate smoking in disease. The George C. Marshall Institute refined these tactics for broader use, producing technically dense reports targeting environmental and public health regulations. These documents, while impressive in appearance and reaching influential policymakers, including presidential advisors, systematically bypassed traditional scientific peer review. Their reports often cherry-picked data or presented misleading interpretations of legitimate research. A striking example occurred when Fred Seitz, leveraging his prestigious background, circulated the Oregon petition refuting global warming. The petition was packaged with a paper deliberately formatted to resemble proceedings from the National Academy of Sciences, forcing the Academy to issue an unprecedented statement disavowing any connection to the initiative. This sophisticated doubt machine received substantial backing from a network of ideologically aligned think tanks funded by conservative foundations, including the Sarah Scaife Foundation, John M. Olin Foundation, and Adolf Kors Foundation, alongside corporate interests like ExxonMobil. Investigative journalist Chris Mooney revealed how ExxonMobil alone channeled over $8 million to 40 different organizations working to challenge climate science consensus. These financial relationships were often obscured through complex funding arrangements and intermediary organizations, making the true sources difficult to trace. A telling shift occurred in the scientific output of these merchants of doubt around the 1970s. Citation analysis through Web of Science reveals that Frederick Seitz's original research publications effectively ceased around 1970, after which he produced primarily book reviews and opinion pieces. Similarly, Fred Singer's publication record shows substantial physics research in the 1950s-60s, but pivoted sharply around 1970 toward commentary pieces and letters to editors. Despite their credentials as physicists, these individuals increasingly spoke outside their areas of expertise, offering opinions on epidemiology, ecology, atmospheric chemistry, and climate modeling, fields requiring specialized knowledge they did not possess. This pattern of abandoning peer-reviewed research in favor of public commentary became a hallmark of the doubt industry's approach. The strategy proved remarkably effective, creating an alternative scientific universe complete with its own experts, publications, and conferences, all designed to manufacture uncertainty around well-established scientific findings that threatened powerful commercial interests. Our fundamental problem is an erroneous view of science. We expect science to provide absolute certainty, but history consistently shows that science actually provides expert consensus based on accumulated evidence and rigorous testing. When scientific questions are truly settled, like the Earth's roundness or gravity's existence, there aren't sides anymore, just accepted knowledge. Yet journalism's he said, she said framework ignores this reality, giving equal weight to individual contrarians and the collective wisdom of thousands of scientists, creating false equivalencies that mislead the public. Modern science is fundamentally a collective enterprise, not the work of isolated heroic individuals, despite popular narratives about lone geniuses. Even breakthrough discoveries like Einstein's relativity theory or Watson and Crick's DNA structure required verification and refinement by the broader scientific community. Science's basic principle remains unchanged for centuries. Ideas must be supported by empirical evidence and subjected to rigorous peer review. Until claims pass this judgment through multiple independent verifications, they remain merely claims. Our contrarians, frustrated by rejection within scientific channels, took their claims directly to public opinion, stepping outside the established protocols that have tested scientific veracity for 400 years. We all make decisions under uncertainty daily, buying cars, houses, choosing insurance, selecting medical treatments, without letting uncertainty paralyze us. As sociologist Michael Smithson notes, all social relations are fundamentally trust relations. We trust doctors to diagnose illness, mechanics to fix cars, pilots to fly planes safely, things we can't do ourselves. Similarly, we must trust scientific experts while carefully evaluating their credentials, research quality, peer review venues, and funding sources. This trust isn't blind faith, but reasoned confidence based on demonstrated expertise and institutional safeguards. When scientific communities organize to judge matters collectively, like the IPCC for climate change or the WHO for public health, we should take their conclusions seriously, rather than dismissing them because of isolated dissenters, especially those with obvious ideological agendas or economic interests at stake. While individual scientists can be wrong, the collective judgment of scientific communities, refined through debate and evidence, provides our best available knowledge. Though science provides no absolute certainty, its robust track record of achievements, from vaccines to semiconductors to weather forecasting, provides a solid basis for action. As epidemiologist Sir Austin Bradford Hill noted in his landmark work on causation, scientific work is always incomplete, but this does not confer upon us a freedom to ignore the knowledge we already have or to postpone the action that it appears to demand at a given time.